Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. Well, today is the half moon night, and the rains retreat. The Vasa is now three quarters completed, so a little over a couple of months have gone by. So the 3 months rains retreat from the full moon of July through to the full moon of October. This period of time for retreat, time for particularly reflection, investigation into the monastic training for the monastic community. This is one of our principal annual periods of focused Dhamma practice. So already three quarters gone, and certainly I feel a sense of the time having raced vigorously by, time passing very swiftly. During the summertime there's often many different activities, different events going on, so the time seems to fly by very, very fast. So tomorrow is the September 21st, it's the autumn equinox, autumnal equinox, the official first day of autumn, the changing of the patterns of light and dark, they are at their peak, so that length of the night is increasing at its greatest rate, the length of the day is shortening at its greatest rate. And the leaves are beginning to turn. You can see just in the trees and the plants around the monastery, that sense of autumnal, the breath of autumn is in the air, leaves starting to turn, and misty quality, especially in the mornings, dew on the grass and certain moist chill in the air. Also, as I was mentioning today, September 21st is a day that nowadays is used, recognized as a World Peace Day, and is a day recognized also taken by many, many organizations, groups around the world to be an occasion to focus on the quality of peace, of reconciliation, of non-conflict, and looking at and trying to support ways human beings can live together, sort out our problems, our differences of opinion, without resorting to armed conflict or even unarmed conflict. And now that these days, with the global communication systems being what they are, that we can hear about details of events happening in countries far away, just right as they're occurring, right on the streets, can follow the progress of protests and conflicts and riots and armed battles, moment by moment, minute by minute, and so that the sense of involvement or the sense of consciousness of conflicts and strife around the world, whether it's in Central America, South America, whether it's in Northern Africa, in the Arab countries, whether it's in the Far East, Southern Asia, or wherever it might be, that we can find out and know in great and gory and shocking detail all of the strifes and struggles that are going on through the whole planet, whether it's North or South Africa or the Pacific, whether it's the Americas or Europe, Middle East, we can know in great detail, so that we can feel a great sense of tension or sadness because of that conflict, and also just to say be supportive of this this kind of effort, this intention to dedicate one's efforts towards peace and reconciliation rather than just further warfare. I think also at this time that there's a grand symposium. There's a meeting that happens every year or two. All the arms manufacturers have a big get together. I think that's happening in Britain at the moment as well. So I don't know how they're celebrating World Peace Day, the arms fair. But if you want to go along and look at the latest weaponry that you can use to kill other people with, then there's opportunities for that as well. Well, in terms of our lives here, and in terms of the Buddhist perspective on conflict, one of the things that that you realize or we recognize that is the case early on is just the idea, even though it's useful and beneficial, important to have the idea of peace between countries, peace between nations, peace between families, peace between individuals, that just the idea on its own is not enough. We can have the goal of peace, and we can admire that, we can look up to that, but the actuality of peace and how to enact that, how to embody that, is something very, very different. As T.S. Eliot put it, between the idea and the fact, there falls the shadow. Between the idea of world peace and peace between nations, peace between families, peace between individuals. Yeah, it's the idea is one thing, but the actuality, the fact, is quite another. And so one of the great blessings that Buddhist practice, Buddhist meditation in particular, can do for us is it can help us to see what the root of conflict is and how we can, say, learn to not be contributing to that, that cause, the causes of conflict, and we can see what the roots of peace, of harmony are, and we can see how we can contribute to that, how we can participate in that. The Buddha pointed out that it's impossible to have say peace between people unless you have there's a quality of peace within ourselves, and one of the important aspects of this time of the year, the rains retreat, the Vassa period, is we have time for individual solitary retreat as well as group retreats. Like we just had a retreat for a couple of weeks over at the retreat center. We began the Vassa with a monastic community group retreat time. There'll be another week at the end. But throughout this time, and the individual nuns and monks have been taking time to have solitary retreat periods, spending many hours a day with walking, sitting meditation, and looking at the mind, looking at how the mind works. And it can be that Amravati is a very active place, has a large community, as we can see. Here's a gathered together on a Tuesday night, 60, 70 people, some outside visitors, many people staying here for a short term, longer term, living here also. It's quite a crowd living here and spending an average day here. And so it's easy to have the feeling, oh, life is so busy, got so much to do, so many things that I'm responsible for, and there's always things going on, and such a charge of activity. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to have some time on a retreat? I'm really looking forward to having my retreat time. I can get away from all these people, all this activity, so that I can at last have some peace go and spend time in a kuti. And get away from it all. Get away from all the people and activity and the many things that I have to do. Fair enough assumption. Certainly attractive enough, interesting enough. But then when we go off have the time by ourselves, and go off to the kuti and And it can easily be the case that the first day or two there's this long, sort of extended sigh of relief of, ah, oh, this is great. No meetings to have to go to, no one to have to fit in with. All I have to do is to remember what time to show up for the meal. You know, go get my bowl, and if I want to eat, go and receive alms food. Otherwise, it's all open. So we can have a sense of relief. At least I can easily experience that. A sense of relief at not having to fit in with anything else. But then after a couple of days of that, just the contrast between having to fit in with the schedule and fit in with other people and to having to work together with the minds and personalities and priorities of others. But then, as one monk many years ago memorably phrased it, there's just the four walls and your mind. There you are in the your dream hut, you know, off at the edges of the property in a quiet corner, and it's just the four walls, the roof, the floor, and your mind. It's day after day, hour after hour, minute after minute, just this mind. And so we begin to see how it can be intriguing how then after a few days of being on solo retreat, you start to really look forward to finding some excuse to go and just cross paths with somebody else. You know, you're looking for the big excitement of walking around the field because you know, something might happen. You know, you might meet somebody, or you'll see a squirrel, or go and have a shower. That'll be exciting. You know, oh, head shaving, whoopee! You know, the big event of the day, doing your laundry. You know. Just some special interesting thing that someone that's got a real good excuse for me to do, and just the agitated mind hankering for some kind of activity. And as Ajahn Chah put it, speaking about this whole dynamic that is so commonly experienced, he said when you're with other people, you want to be alone. When you're alone, you miss your friends. But peace doesn't come from being with others or from being alone. Peace comes from right understanding, from samadhiti. That's where real peace comes, because we can sense that, you know, I'm not experiencing peace because there's so much to do. I have to be in the kitchen. I have to go work on to paint all these buildings. You know, how many acres of wall do we have to paint in this place? How many windows are there? You know? How many acres of grass have to be cut? You know? All these people, all these things. And then, if only I could have some peace. And then there's the opportunity for peace, and then there's the mind with all of its memories and its plans and its appetites, its urgencies, its desire for activity, or its desire to switch off and to not feel, not be. And we can blame our mind, you know, blame our conditioning, blame our own spiritual weaknesses for causing a lack of peacefulness. Or we can blame other people, we can blame the environment, blame the monastery for our lack of peacefulness. Just as we can blame the government, you know, or we can blame the family. You know, if only I wasn't in this family with these difficult people, if I wasn't working in this place with these difficult, troublesome people, if only I was in another country, if only. And certainly, obviously, there are degrees of conflict that are relative. You know, if people are getting shot in the streets and having rocket-propelled grenades, you know, fired through your the windows of your house, and your family being blown to pieces, that's conflict and stress and pain on a whole different scale than just grumbling about the people that work in the office with you, or an ongoing, say, territorial war with your siblings, you know, over family properties. And so I certainly acknowledge there's there's differences of scale. No problem. Life is not under our control. So whether it's conflict with your own jitta and your embarrassment about not having switched your cell phone off, or conflict with your neighbouring country, and still even though there is a genuine differences of scale, there's differences of intensity of feeling, but still, in that very simple nugget of insight that Ajahn Chah expressed, peace doesn't. When you're with people, you want to be alone. When you're alone, you want to be with your friends. But peace doesn't come from being with others or being alone. Peace comes from right understanding. So that peace in the heart is not dependent on circumstance. It's not dependent on whether there's a lot of noise or whether there's quietude. It's not dependent on whether there's stress in the living situation or whether there is tranquility. Yeah. Even to some extent, even in a war zone, even when there is gunfire in the streets and people being injured and lives being torn apart, it's still up to us, remarkably so, whether we make a problem out of it or not. And this is something that is a very helpful principle, I find, that the Buddha points to, that it's always up to us, it's always up to the individual, whether we create dukkha out of life's situations, even when there's something that's really worthy of blame, of criticism, even when we have a reasonable complaint. And the way he illustrates this, the Buddha was the genius at coming up with extremely graphic and memorable similes and images. So the one that comes to mind in this instance is what's called the simile of the saw. And the Buddha uses this image of being kidnapped by bandits. So if you are kidnapped by a group of bandits, and they are cutting your arms and legs off with a two-handled saw, so you're tied down, and there's a couple of people, a person at either end of a two-handed saw, and they're sawing your arms and legs off, sawing away. And that is a situation where you would feel it's absolutely justified to have a bit of negativity towards the people who are murdering you, killing you, cutting you up and torturing you, that you think a little bit of reasonable aversion would be allowable. just a smidgen, just to say, well, excuse me, this is my body you're cutting up. But the Buddha said, if you give rise to aversion towards the people that are perpetrating that, if you give rise to aversion on account of what they're doing, if you cultivate negativity towards them, then you're not following his teaching. You're not. Your heart cannot be in alignment with the Dhamma. You're not following the teaching. So that's a pretty tall order. This is Olympic class Dhamma practice. In some respects, you can think, well, I couldn't possibly manage that, or how could I hope to do that? But what the Buddha's doing that he's creating this very, very graphic image, and deliberately using a situation where you think it's completely reasonable to have some aversion or some hatred towards other beings, that they really are harming you, they really are deliberately causing you misery. But he said, even in a situation like that, it's that sense of negativity and ill feeling, extending ill will towards others, is out of accord with Dhamma. It has to be. And so, what he encourages is, rather you should be thinking, I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness. This is what you should be, that the chant that we do on the Brahma Viharas, the suffusion with divine abidings, that comes from the simile of the saw, that's right there in that sutta, in the middle length discourses. The, I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So as you're lying there, having your arms and legs sliced off, then what he's encouraging that you come to mind with is that, you know, may you be happy, may you be at ease, abundant, exalted, immeasurable. And so that's a tall order. And it might seem quite ridiculous or impractical. But what the Buddha's pointing to in that is saying that it's always up to us, even in the most testing and difficult situations, whether we create a problem out of it or not. We always have the capacity to bring the heart into accord with the situation that we're experiencing, regardless of how easy or reasonable it seems to be to complain. And obviously the experience of being kidnapped and tortured by others is fairly rare, at least in this part of the world, this country, this time. But the kinds of torture that we do experience, chronic illness, of having chronic illness, the pain in the body, or terminal illnesses, or psychological pain of long-lasting stresses and strains within our family, long-lasting sort of tensions and conflicts and so forth, that we might feel similar degrees of oppression, having someone who's close to us who is very burdensome, or who's causing a lot of difficulty in our lives, or our own body being filled with pain and ailments. And so that we can see the mind moving towards complaining or criticizing, blaming, and moving towards that habit of reasonable hatred, wanting to take refuge in complaining. But it is impossible to complain your way to Nibbana, I guarantee. there is no way you can follow that track and arrive at peacefulness. So the peace that comes from right understanding, the peace is entirely in the attitude. The peace is not just in a tranquil world. The peace that is being talked about in this respect, it's not everybody around us living harmoniously and respectfully with each other. It's not all the fights disappearing from the world around us, or the violence disappearing from the animal world. It's more to do with the peace of our attitude. The peace, as Ajahn Chah put it, that peace comes from right understanding, right view. Now, in this respect, there's different ways that you can characterize right view, but one of the ways that comes to mind, I think it also comes to mind because in the Kuti where I live, that Lumpur Sumedho had this piece of calligraphy pinned up on the board in the little sort of kitchen area, little kitchenette. Up on there's a small notice board on the wall, and he had this big, most of the notice board is taken up with this quotation from the Buddha about right view. And it's saying that one who has right view understands that all that arises is arising dukkha. All that arises is dukkha arising. Everything that arises is arising dukkha. And when things cease, what's ceasing is dukkha, is ceasing. That if it's a thing coming into being, then there is dukkha, there's dissatisfaction that comes with that. But when the thing ceases, then what is ceasing is dukkha. Dukkha is ceasing. There's just arising dukkha and ceasing dukkha, and that encompasses the whole universe of experience. Every experience that we have, whether it's an external object, whether it's a work project that we have, whether it's an encounter with another person, whether it's a thought in our mind, whether it's a feeling in the body or a mood, that if it arises, if it takes shape, if it's something that is known, then it's in its very thingness, there is dukkha. And then when it ceases, then there is dukkha ceasing in that. And this is one way that the Buddha characterized right view. What arises is just arising dukkha. What ceases is just ceasing dukkha. This is an unusual way of categorizing the world, because we tend to think of the world in terms of good and bad and right and wrong and inside and outside, beautiful, ugly, coarse and fine, pure and impure. But what the Buddha is doing with this is just saying that if we understand the way that the mind works, we can see that if there's a thing coming into being, if there's the mind holding some event as a thing, then right there in that thingness, right there in that compounding and compoundedness of that experience, there is dukkha. There is a quality of dissatisfaction. There is a quality of incompleteness and imperfection, just in its very compoundedness. Like one of the most frequently recited passages in this respect: sabbe sankhara dukkha, all compounded things are unsatisfactory. Sabbe sankhara dukkha, all compounded things are unsatisfactory. And they're unsatisfactory because they're compounded, which means they've come together, therefore they'll fall apart. Therefore they cannot, even if they're pleasant when they're here, they cannot last forever. And so even if they're utterly pleasant in their manifestation, then the dukkha of them is that they can't please us permanently. They can't sustain that quality. They can't cause the experience of satisfaction to last forever. They are bound to disappoint. They're bound to leave a sense of incompleteness and sadness in their wake. And during this 2-week retreat, I guess this had the subject of dukkha and anicca dukkha anatta, unsatisfactoriness and impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and not-self had come up as the three characteristics of existence. And there's one dear person on the retreat when we had started the group interviews, he wanted to contend that Bach's concertos were not unsatisfactory. That Bach, there were certain pieces of Bach that were actually entirely perfect and completely satisfactory conditions in nature. So I said, well, so you're meaning to say that there are these few compounded things that are sort of outside the laws that the Buddha describes? Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I mean, the Bach's concertos are really, they're in a different category, Bhante. I said, well, you know, yes, it might be the case that while you're listening to them, they are utterly perfect and to your ear. But, you know, if you were a blackbird or if you were an insect, you wouldn't necessarily hear those sounds as beautiful music. They might be actually just uninteresting or discordant or unpleasant to you. And he said, but I'm not a blackbird. I'm not a worm. So therefore, Bach's concertos are, in fact, absolutely perfect. So we went back and forth about this and agreed to disagree eventually. But this is, Buddhist teachings are always offered for consideration rather than being put forward as sort of diktats that people we're supposed to believe. So in saying these things, like all that arises is arising dukkha and all that ceases is ceasing dukkha, I'm also aware that might sound a bit too much of a sweeping statement or might seem like a strange way of categorizing all experience. But this is worthy of consideration and worthy of contemplating, because what the Buddha is saying is not that every experience is unpleasant, because there's delightful feelings, pleasant feelings, the happy feelings. They can be experienced, but in their very compoundedness, in their very conditionality, the very fact that they arise and are only able to be sustained for a period of time and then they cease, that very conditioned nature of them, that's what is their unsatisfactoriness, that is their quality of dukkha. It's, even if it's like a... if you're a musical person and you adore Bach and then you hear Bach's concerto in D minor, you think it's utterly perfect. Then you are, in that respect, you're conditioning the mind to be habituated to the presence of that particular thing. And so then when you hear Bach's concerto in D minor and somebody plays it badly, then because you're habituated to it being done right, then when it's being done wrong, how could they do that? How could they butcher it? Speaking of which, I mentioned this because the I actually do possess a cell phone myself, a BlackBerry, and the ringtone that I have set on it is Bach's Concerto in D minor. And I didn't have the heart to confess to this dear fellow on the retreat that one of his that his blessed and sacred piece of music was being co-opted to be in this very unexalted role in the universe of being the ringtone on my BlackBerry. I had a feeling he would disapprove. maybe he would. So that we don't see that's why something that we think is beautiful, like a beautiful relationship, or looking at the way that we relate to like a great spiritual teacher like the Buddha, or you know, Ajahn Chah, or the mind can say, "What's there? That's the Buddha was a perfect being. He was absolutely marvelous, and there's the ideal." Of the human condition perfected, you know, that was right there. This is a perfect thing. But also the Buddha would say, and did many times, sabbe sankhara dukkha, you know, if it's come together, then it's unsatisfactory. And that he would refer to his own physical being in that way. You know, this is the body is dukkha. You know, the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, these are all anicca, dukkha, anatta. They are transient, uncertain, ownerless, unsatisfactory. They can't please permanently, you know, in and of themselves. But then also, as things fade away, then what's fading is dukkha, fading. So as things cease, in that when that condition comes to an end, then there is the cessation of that dukkha, that unsatisfactoriness, when the mind is not fixated on that thing, or is not creating that thingness, because in a sense, you know, we impute the quality of thingness. We make a thing, like we call this a clock, or we call this, you know, a chair, a Dhamma seat. You know, we create that chairness from our own perceptions. This was an oak tree, or a collection of oak trees a number of years ago. And then the oak tree got cut down and sliced up into planks, and then somebody commissioned this Dhamma seat to be made, and then the bits of oak tree that had started out as an acorn and soil and sunlight and rain, and then they got reconfigured and turned into Amaravati Dhamma seat. And then in due course, there is now chairing going on. So that we call it a chair as a sort of solid, permanent thing, but it's more accurate to say, well, there is chairing going on at the moment. This particular patch of the universe is chairing, and then sooner or later it will fall apart. The elements will separate, and its chairness will disappear. It's like the example the Buddha used was like a chariot. If you look at this and you say it's a chariot, and they say, well, where's the essential chariotness there? If you take off the wheels, if you take off take out the axle, if you take off the surround, you remove the platform, you take all the parts, the bits away from each other, where's the essential chariotness? You just have a collection of bits of wood and metal and wire and leather. There's no essential chariot. But when they put them together, you make that designation. You designate it chariot, or you designate it Dhamma seat, or you designate it person. And that very designation, when we take that to be a solid reality, right there, that's the dukkha, is that when we create thingness, when we make that into a solid, even though it's don't spell it out so categorically to ourselves. This is what we do unconsciously. We say, oh, well, that's a chair. That's a person. Yeah, it's a Dhamma hall. That's Amaravati. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's you. Because we are very accustomed to these patterns of speech. But if we're seeing with the eye of Dhamma, if we're seeing with right view, if there's a clear seeing, then what we'll recognize is that, oh, in that very imputing of substance, of reality to that thing, to that set of experiences, right there is dukkha. And as soon as that designation is not given or is not seen as being solid, as soon as we recognize, oh yeah, there's just personing, there's templing, there's chairing, there are these events or patterns of experience going on, we realize that the word is more verbs and adverbs rather than nouns and pronouns. That then there's a lightness in the heart, there's an attunement of the heart to the reality of it. We see that that's just a conventional way of describing it. And we see that when that thingness is not there, when we don't create that solidity, that rigid perceptions of self and other, of a thing existing in time, then there's a lightness, a spaciousness in the heart. So when we, as the Buddha puts it, in that very simple little synopsis, when what ceases is merely dukkha ceasing. When we use that all-encompassing vision, then that really changes the way that we look at our moods, we look at our feelings of elation, inspiration, and happiness. If the mind is peaceful and bright and full of kindness, we might think, oh, this is really great, my practice is going really well, what a lovely day. And we're grasping that, we're calling that mind, giving that mood a substance. And so then we become elated by that particular feeling, and not realizing, oh, that this is an arisen state, it's that, therefore it's dukkha. And so when that arisen state changes, or when it's that wonderful experience that you had during the retreat, that kind of glorious, beautiful, clear, pure mind state, that when at last you understood everything and your heart was really at peace, then that's a wonderful day 5, day 6 experience. Then if we get elated over that and get intoxicated, we take it as a real thing, then the dukkha that's there is that when we get to the next meditation period, we can't get back to it, then we feel an experience of loss, or that something comes along and interrupts it. There's a lorry comes and parks outside your window to make some deliveries, or they decide to mow the grass just outside your kuti that day. Then, that beautiful, blissful feeling, that wonderful transcendent knowledge, then because some good person is coming along on the mower, Richard or James is tootling past with a mowing machine, then you want to murder them. And these homicidal feelings can arise. How can they ruin my samadhi? It's just on the brink of full realization, and now they're mowing the bloody grass. And don't they realize they're ruining my practice? In exactly this way, there's a famous, within the forest monastery circles, a famous declaration by Ajahn Mahabua about how when he was a young monk and he was training with Ajahn Mun, he'd spent a lot of time by himself and had managed to develop some very, very deep states of absorption, was extremely concentrated and had these brilliant and bright, wonderfully blissful, spacious states of mind. And he went back to, after being away and practicing by himself for a few months and really being quite pleased with how his practice was sort of progressing, quote unquote, he went back to Ajahn Mun, and so Ajahn Mun asked him the usual fateful question, so how's the practice going? He said, well, actually, things are pretty good, really. I've been able to sit, the mind goes right into Arupa Jhana, and I can sit there for hours and hours, days at a time, really, quite happily absorbed, blissfully imbued with these wonderfully bright, wholesome, clear states, so that, I'm actually quite pleased with how the meditation's going. And expecting, as he said, that Ajahn Mun was going to say, oh, well done, Mahabua, this is good stuff, you well done, lad, you're heading in the right direction, just keep going, I'm pleased, congratulating him, praising him, that's what he was expecting. But instead, Ajahn Mun just said, that won't really do you very much good. It'd be far better if you just don't let the mind get so absorbed and just establish just simple axis concentration, neighborhood concentration, just enough mindfulness to watch the rising and passing away of the five aggregates, the five khandhas. And yeah, any more absorption than that is kind of a waste of time, really. It's just, you know, you're just kind of fooling around and mucking about. It's not going to do you any good at all, really. And so one of the reasons why this is famous as a story is because Ajahn Mahabodh then admits that he got into an argument with Ajahn Mun, and they went so head to head with raised voices for an extended period of time that people could hear, you know, around the monastery for some distance. This young monk kind of objecting and criticizing, arguing with the teacher, but neither of them were going to back off. And so eventually Ajahn Mahabodh decided that, he would respectfully choose to disagree with Ajahn Mun, and took his leave and went off and went back to try and continue with his practice and to revisit those bright and beautiful mind states. But of course, having argued with his teacher and having had this sort of the advice to not get so absorbed, that something in him couldn't forget that. Something couldn't ignore that. And so he found that he couldn't get back into those same states of absorption. And that no matter how hard he tried and how fiercely and intently he tried to focus his mind, and no matter how hard he worked, he just couldn't get back to those states of quietude and focus, states of absorption. And he made the comment, if it had been anyone other than Ajahn Mun, Thanachan Mun, who'd caused me to lose those beautiful mind states, I would have killed them. So, here you have this great master, you know, later on became the Arahant, an Arahant and a most highly revered teacher in Thailand, saying that he was experiencing homicidal feelings towards his own teacher on the basis of these very beautiful and wholesome states. That's why even things like, you know, arupa jhana, where you sit with the mind in enraptured with bliss for like 3 or 4 days, a week at a time, a couple of weeks at a time without moving, that can be seen as dukkha, because when you can no longer get it, when it's no longer accessible, then you feel bereavement, you feel murderous feelings towards that which you see as having caused you not to be able to experience it, therefore dukkha. The very feeling of it being a real thing, and that you being the owner of it, these insidious qualities of attachment, identification, and solidification, they creep into the mix and cause us to create dukkha around that. But when we don't do that, when we see clearly, when we see that, oh, this is just dukkha arising, this even this beautiful bright mind state, this lovely wholesome quality, this beautiful thing that we're bringing into the world, this is just dukkha arising, and then when it comes to an end, there's just dukkha ceasing. Also, even in that moment, when you see that, oh, this is empty, this is not self, this is just the patterns of nature coming and going and changing, in that very moment of seeing through its thingness, seeing its transparency in a way, seeing that there's no thing there, no real thing there, in that moment, then what happens is that the dukkha ceases. As long as there is thingness, there is dukkha. When the thingness ceases, then the dukkha ceases, either through the conditions of running out and dissolving, or it being seen through, its insubstantiality, its transparency being known. So this might sound like high-minded philosophy, but this is absolutely directly useful for our own practice, dealing with our own moods. You know, if we are feeling restless, and we're feeling despondent, sad, or lonely, it's feeling like I'm in the wrong place, or this isn't, you know, my practice is useless, or my mind is so terrible, I'm filled with so much fear and aversion, and I'm just so utterly mediocre, I'm so wishy-washy, I'm a failed meditator. Then, if we recognize, oh, this is a mind state, this is just a thing that has arisen, this is dukkha that has arisen, and in its presence, it's uncomfortable in its presence, but it's just to be able to say, oh, this is just arisen dukkha. That's all that's happening. This is just a condition that's come into being. It's supposed to be dukkha. This is what they all are. They're always unsatisfactory. To know it simply as a mood, to be able to feel its presence, to recognize, oh, this is an arisen thing. This attitude, this mood, this feeling. Just as if it's a bright and beautiful mood, a beautiful mind state, a lovely, elated, enthusiastic, cheerful, bright and wholesome mood, to be able to say, oh, this is dukkha, this wonderful, joyful, cheerful mind state, this beautiful state of clarity and bliss, this is just dukkha that's arisen. And this might sound like a very negative or sour approach, yeah, it's all dukkha, pah, the kind of grumpy, sort of negative, interpreting that point of view as being sort of negative or as a put down. It's not at all. It's just saying that this is its nature. This is this in itself cannot satisfy. This is just an ordinary, imperfect aspect of nature. That's all. It's just doing. It's just nature doing its thing. That's all. That's all it is. That's all it can be. Nothing to get dejected about. Nothing to get elated about. So that in that respect, we're able to stay balanced and focused. There's a centeredness, an equanimity, in what the Buddha called tatra majjatata, or being in the middle of things. That in a way is the perfectly equanimous heart, the quality of upeka, of equanimity, of serenity, evenness of mind, is that quality of centeredness, tatra majjatata, being in the middle of thatness, literally. There's a centeredness. Oh yeah, this is just a bright feeling. This is an average feeling. This is a sad feeling. That's what it is. As soon as we buy into it and we think, oh, I'm sad, or I'm excited, or I'm inspired, or you know, I'm feeling lazy, or I'm tired, you know, I'm agitated. As soon as the I am takes hold of it, we're not in the middle anymore. We're out being swung around on the periphery. There's an aspect of being sort of caught, the heart caught and entangled in those states. But the more that it's able to be recognized, oh, this is simply an arisen state. That's what it is. This is an arisen thing. It's not an absolute fact. It's not an absolute reality. This is just a mood that has arisen. This feeling of sadness, or this feeling of loneliness, or this feeling of excitement, or indignation. This feeling of jealousy or fear. It's an arisen thing. It's not an accurate picture of the universe or an accurate description of the ultimate reality of things. It's just a feeling. It's just a mood. It's just a texture. That's all it can be. How could it be more than that? If it's an arisen thing, it's anicca, dukkha, anatta. It inexorably, inevitably, inescapably follows those laws. Those are the characteristics of all things. And in seeing that, then there's that quality of centeredness, that quality of being in the middle is established. There's a genuine and fundamental equanimity in relationship to that. And along with those characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, of impermanence or uncertainty, anicca, not sureness, not fixedness, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness or incompleteness, inadequacy, anatta, the things not being self. These are, the Buddha described these as being the characteristics of all existent things. If it's a thing, then it's necessarily anicca, dukkha, anatta, that this is all things, pure and impure, internal, external, coarse or refined, pleasant or painful, they all have these characteristics, every single one. Along with these, there are other characteristics that all things also possess, and that this was pointed out particularly by Ajahn Buddhadasa. He talked about the nine dhas, or the nine the nine, it's a pun in the Thai language that the word da means I, but all these qualities also end with the Pali word, Pali syllable T, long A, ta, which means the quality of, or the presence of that attribute. So anicca means impermanence. Anicca means impermanent. Anicca means impermanence. Or dukkha means unsatisfactoriness. Dukkha means unsatisfactory. It's the adjective. Dukkha means unsatisfactoriness. Anatta means not selfness, or the fact of not being self. So then the other of the others, it's also helpful to reflect upon. This Ajahn Buddhadasa outlined the next three as dhammata, that all things are of the nature of dhamma, that's their fabric, that they are of the fabric of dhamma. They are of the nature of dhamma, dhammata. They are dhammatitata, which means they are established in dhamma. That they take their shape and their form according to the laws of nature, and dhamma niyamata, that they function, the way they change, the way they act, also follows the laws of nature. So dhammata, dhamma titata, dhamma niyamata, so they have the substance of dhamma, the function according to the laws of dhamma, and the appearance, the way they look, the way they're formed, is also in accordance with dhamma, with the way nature is. This is again the characteristic of all things. They all of the fabric and form of dhamma. And also a couple of these were that he outlined were sunyata, the things are empty. They have the characteristic of emptiness, empty of self and what belongs to a self. And also tatata, the suchness. There's the quality of presence, of isness, if you like. Now, the more that we can look at a mood or a feeling, an experience, whether we're feeling happy or excited, or feeling sad and dejected, whether we're feeling comfortable or uncomfortable, the more that we can see, oh, this is just Dhamma following its own patterns. This is all. Its substance is Dhamma, its appearance is in accord with Dhamma, it's the way it functions, is according to the laws of Dhamma, then it makes it all a lot less personal. It makes it very clear, oh, this is just nature doing its thing. There's this feeling of anger, this feeling of disappointment, this feeling of excitement, this feeling of this beautiful mind state, this chattering, endless obsessive thought. This is just nature doing its thing, that's all. Just like the chattering of the birds having their conversations and arguments in the morning, their little territorial stakeouts, the bird song is making every morning. It's just nature doing its thing. It's like the thoughts that arise in our mind, the phrases that form, the memories, the regrets, the nostalgia, the delights, the inspired ideas, the unwholesome passions. This is just nature doing its thing. And then the heart that recognizes, oh, this is just dukkha arising, this is just dukkha ceasing, this is just nature forming shapes dissolving, this is just the way that life works. Then there's a tremendous spaciousness, an extraordinary lightness, an extraordinary openness. Because we find the heart is unafraid. There's there's a quality of imperturbability or intrepidity. There's a fearlessness. The heart can be open to all experiences. The pleasant ones, you're not trying to hang on to them and you're afraid that they're going to go away. Or the ones that are uncomfortable, you're not afraid that they're going to come in and take over. Or that you're going to be stressed or burdened with that forever. You can just let it in, breathe it all in, take it in, know it, and let it all go. That there's a fearlessness there. There's a limitless openness of the heart. There's a quality of centeredness. So when we use a term like right view, it can seem a little bit clinical or remote, but it has also this powerful tone also to it. The right view has this quality of infinite spaciousness, also of the receptivity. There's a sense of unbiased receptivity, an open-heartedness and a fearlessness, nothing to be afraid of. Nothing can get damaged, nothing can be lost, nothing can burden us, nothing can stress us. There's that sense of, you know, of freedom, of what's here that could be taken away, what's here that could be corrupted, what's here that could be lost, what's here that could be destroyed. It's just Dhamma. It can't lose anything, it can't gain anything, it can't be hurt, it can't be damaged, it can't be lost. So what's to be afraid of? What's to be anxious about? What's the worry? So in terms of particularly of our of time in retreats and using the opportunities that we have for during this period for formal practice, just this night that we have the vigil together, and then all the other times that we have either in formal retreat mode or outside of retreat in an ordinary everyday work in the office, the library, the kitchen, on the workplace, wherever it might be. You see, this is how we establish peace within ourselves. That the real peace comes from this quality of right view, of this perfectly balanced view, that sense of the being at the center of things, being in the middle of everything, that centeredness of view and openness of view. This is how we really establish peace within ourselves, so that when something comes along that is appealing or gladdening, we don't chase after it and try to own it. We don't get entranced or bedazzled by that. If something comes along that is oppressive or threatening, we don't run away and hide or contend against it or run away from it. Far more, the heart is able to respond. So whether something is attractive or unattractive, whether it's appealing or threatening, whether it's wanted or unwanted, expected or unexpected, then the heart can relate to that from a place of responsiveness. So what we do, or what we say, if we move towards something and engage, or whether we just hold back or be still, whether we say something or be quiet, whether we engage in activity or just leave things alone and walk away, all of those choices are guided by that quality of right view, of attunement to the situation, attunement to the people that you're with, the work that's going on, the environment that we are a part of, that quality of attunement then guides our actions, guides our speech, guides the things to be done. In this way, guided by wisdom, by mindfulness, by kindness, and selfishness. That's what guides our actions and our response. So then we can live at peace with things. Even if others are not being peaceful with us, we can be at peace with them. And not being a sort of, I'm being at peace, sort of there, I'm sort of blanking you out and just saying, yeah, you're empty, you don't exist, I'm going to be peaceful in here and sort of blot you out. No, that's not a wise or a real kind of peacefulness. The peace is not just walling ourselves off behind a veneer or a barrier of aversion or just isolation. It's not that. This peace is based upon an openness to things, is based on an attunement to the way things are, but a radical non-contention with the way things are. It's a peace that's open to the world. It's open to all things, connected to all things, and participating in all things, but is unconfused by them. Is, say, attuned to the way things are, so that the even if others are being aggressive or difficult, then you don't react blindly to that. You draw upon the resources of wisdom, your own intuitive wisdom, the capacity of your own heart to respond appropriately to the situation. You're drawing upon the heart's intrinsic relatedness to the nature of all things to guide action and speech. Your heart is a part of the whole order of the universe, the nature of your own being. Your own heart is a part of the whole natural order. So you draw upon your heart's relatedness to that natural order. It's relatedness to all things. And out of that relatedness, out of that sense of attunement, then where we speak or act in accordance with what's useful, what's appropriate. And now that I see that speaking of mindfulness, the clock has wound its way around to 9:47, so that's about the hour. So I will offer these thoughts for reflection this evening, and whatever has been useful, please take that and use that, and whatever has not been useful, then please leave that aside. Dhammayang Dhamma Avadakata Sadhu Karanda Dhamma Se.